In 1983, I decided to become a community organizer. There wasn't much detail to the idea. I didn't know anyone making a living that way. When classmates in college asked me just what it was that a community organizer did, I couldn't answer them directly. Instead, I'd pronounce on the need for change. Change won't come from the top, I would say. Change will come from a mobilized grassroots. That's what I'll do. I'll organize black folks at the grassroots for change. And my friends, black and white, would heartily commend me for my ideals before heading toward the post office to mail in their graduate school applications. I couldn't really blame them for being skeptical. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, I can construct a certain logic to my decision, show how becoming an organizer was part of that larger narrative, starting with my father and his father before him, my mother and her parents, my memories of Indonesia, with its beggars and farmers and the loss of Lolo to power, on through Ray and Regina, and my move to New York, my father's death. I can see that my choices were never truly mine alone, and that that is how it should be, that to assert otherwise is to chase after a sorry sort of freedom. But such recognition only came later. At the time, about to graduate from college, I was operating mainly on impulse, like a salmon swimming blindly upstream toward the site of his own conception. In classes and seminars, I would dress up these impulses in the slogans and theories that I'd discovered in books, thinking, falsely, that the slogans meant something, that they somehow made what I felt more amenable to proof. But at night, lying in bed, I would let the slogans drift away, to be replaced with a series of images, romantic images, of a past I had never known. They were of the civil rights movement, mostly, the grainy black-and-white footage that appears every February during Black History Month, the same images that my mother had offered me as a child. A pair of college students, hair short, back straight, placing their orders at a lunch counter teetering on the edge of riot. SNCC workers standing on a porch in some Mississippi backwater, trying to convince a family of sharecroppers to register to vote. A county jail bursting with children, their hands clasped together, singing freedom songs. Such images became a form of prayer for me, bolstering my spirits, channeling my emotions in a way that words never could. They told me, although even this much understanding may have come later, is also a construct, containing its own falsehoods, that I wasn't alone in my particular struggles, and that communities had never been a given in this country, at least not for blacks. Communities had to be created, fought for, tended like gardens. They expanded or contracted with the dreams of men, and in the civil rights movement, those dreams had been large. In the sit-ins, the marches, the jailhouse songs, I saw the African-American community becoming more than just the place where you had been born or the house where you'd been raised. Through organizing, through shared sacrifice, membership had been earned. And because membership was earned, because this community I imagined was still in the making, built on the promise that the larger American community, black, white, and brown, could somehow redefine itself, I believed that it might, over time, admit the uniqueness of my own life. That was my idea of organizing. It was a promise of redemption. And so, in the months leading up to graduation, I wrote to every civil rights organization I could think of, to any black elected official in the country with a progressive agenda, to neighborhood councils and tenant rights groups. When no one wrote back, I wasn't discouraged. I decided to find more conventional work for a year, to pay off my student loans, and maybe even save a little bit. Eventually, a consulting house to a multinational corporation agreed to hire me as a research assistant. Like a spy behind enemy lines, I arrived every day at my mid-Manhattan office and sat at my computer terminal, checking the Reuters machine that blinked bright emerald messages from across the globe. As far as I could tell, I was the only black man in the company, a source of shame for me, but a source of considerable pride for the company's secretarial pool.